Exciting times then. Are you still going to be, you know, working at JB just remotely?
Yep.
Cool.
One of the reasons I want gigabit internet is so I just have a nice fat link, and then I can blame all the slowness on Chris.
That's true.
Mr. Martin Wimpress, welcome back to the User Air program. We are delighted to have you here, sir.
Well, thanks for having me back on. I think this is the first time since May.
Since the reboot.
Yeah, that's
when we you were our reboot guest, and that's why it feels like it's a milestone to have you back. And you and I share a common, I don't know if I should call it a passion, but definitely an interest. And we're just going to start and get this out of the way at the top of the show. It's Bitcoin. We got a lot of feedback from recent episodes where people said, talk a little bit more about Bitcoin, just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk a little bit more about Bitcoin. It's at 11,659 U.S. greenbacks as we record this episode. And I think, Wimby, didn't you and I think we probably got into Bitcoin around the same time, yeah?
Yeah, I got into Bitcoin in sort of early 2010.
Yeah, it was somewhere around there for me. I can't quite remember. I know we first started covering it as a subtopic for TechSnap, which is actually when I got into mining and had a bunch of Bitcoin stolen and like 40 or something like that. It might have even been more, which is mind-numbing to think about it now that I had more than 40 Bitcoins stolen from me when they're at $11,000 each right now.
Oh, my. Yeah.
Yeah, my biggest regret was not spending $50 in Bitcoin back in 2011.
Yeah. Yeah, when we ended Plan B, I think it was around $140, and then the next week we started Linux Unplugged. So that was how long ago that was.
And I think wasn't that just after we'd had a big crash as well? Because I think it had been up over $1,000, and then it really tumbled.
Yeah,
and it tumbled a bit further because I can remember after that buying Bitcoin for $50 a coin.
Right. Yep. I know the most I ever paid, I think, was $200 for 2 bitcoins. I did, and that was one of my last Bitcoin transactions, where I purchased Bitcoin, and it was a physical in person local like Bitcoin purchase thing. It wasn't like so I got a way better deal than you get through the exchanges.
Yeah.
Did you mine most of your Bitcoin that you've had over the ages and now have spent some of, or most of perhaps?
yes, I think I did. I think on balance I've probably mined the majority from the very early days. So I got into Bitcoin because I was into folding at home, and I was part of a folding at home team. And through that, Bitcoin, you know, entered people's, you know, consciousness, people that were doing folding. And some of those teams, you know, moved away from folding at home and SETI and stuff like that and started competitively mining Bitcoin, just like we had been on these other projects. So I didn't really get into it because I thought that this was ever going to be worth anything. I got into it for, you know, shits and giggles. It was, you know, I had a number of machines that did this sort of thing. And then when it did actually start to become worth like more than a dollar, and at that point I had some hundreds of bitcoins, you know, it was like, okay, well, this is kind of interesting now. And I invested some of those coin, you know, I mean, can you remember the days of Mt. Gox and the heart and mouth moments of, you know, transactions to fiat currencies? It was just, it was, I could lose it all or I could get some money kind of arrangement. There was no certainty involved.
There was no Coinbase.
So, you know, Rika, I was saying about regretting spending money, but I cashed in hundreds of dollars of Bitcoin to buy ATI graphics cards to up my compute power.
Because that
was the way to do it.
Yep.
But then quickly, you know, recovered that investment because at that time the difficulty was relatively low.
Yeah, you could do it all on the GPU, which today would just be a waste. You're burning up a graphics card, at least for Bitcoin. There's other cryptocurrencies that are worth mining on the GPU that you could then sell for Bitcoin, which is probably, if I was going to buy Bitcoin today, how I would do it is I would get back into mining and I would mine an altcoin, which I guess is a derogatory term. I guess they don't like being called altcoins. But I would mine another cryptocurrency that has a lower difficulty, and then I would sell that at an exchange for Bitcoin and just buy small chunks of Bitcoin, because you don't have to buy an entire Bitcoin at a time. And much like Wimpy, I got into Bitcoin because I was super jazzed up about shared computing, network computing, like everything working on a shared project. That's what initially interested me in Bitcoin. I was a folding at home user as well. And then, just like Wimpy, I started looking at the technology and the money behind it, and I started sort of all kind of connecting. And then it was, oh shit, this is open source money. This is money that has been turned into a protocol. This is money for the internet. This is money that supersedes states. It's money that is cryptographically verifiable, and that cryptographic layer is upgradable to combat future types of decryption, like quantum computing. It's a really technically amazing product. Like just from like the technological achievement, it was just mind-numbingly awesome. And that was sort of all in. I started, and it turned out a lot of the mining systems worked great, and there was on Linux, and there was Linux Live CDs started coming out where you could just boot up various systems and it would start mining. And then I was all in, Wimpy. Did you get into some of those?
Yes. I mean, right next to me is my old mining machine. It's a Dell Precision 7400. Which has two quad-core Xeon processors in it. And when it was delivered, it had two NVIDIA Quadro graphics cards in it, which, for the uninitiated, mining Bitcoin on NVIDIA cards is beyond awful.
Yeah.
But at that time, you could mine on the CPU, and those CPUs were fairly heady. So that's what I started on, and then replaced those Quadros with ATI and AMD cards, like the 5500 series, I think. And that was my main mining rig. And then I had some, I experimented with some of these USB ASICs as well. But at that point, it was just getting to the point where they weren't able to, you know, punch through the difficulty sufficiently. So they were $100, $200 a go. And I had a USB HUD with five or six of those.
Oh, connected. Those are the later ones. Those are the nicer ones where they would just go right in the USB slots. Yeah, I got screwed by like Butterfly Labs and their big box. And by the time that I even received the ASIC hardware, the difficulty level had gone up to a level that meant that that thing was basically going to be like sifting for shards of gold downstream and not actually getting any nuggets.
Yeah.
It was kind of disappointing.
And to what you were saying about mining altcoin, you'll remember from the discussions on Linux Unplugged, I've been experimenting with external graphics enclosures.
Yeah.
And I have the Razer Core version 1 and version 2 now. I've got my NVIDIA 1080 Ti in the Razer Core V2.
Is that all purchased with Bitcoin, by the way?
I've done a little bit of experimenting with Ethereum on that. Nothing serious yet, but a little bit of experimenting.
That's where I'm thinking of going too.
And then
interesting.
On the Razer Core V1, I've just recently put an AMD RX Vega 56 in that, and I'm going to have a serious look at mining some altcoin on that and see how that compares. And also, I want to see how gaming performance evolves on that platform as well. So there's a little Christmas New Year project in the offing there.
Interesting. And so you're mining Ethereum on an external eGPU graphics enclosure?
Yeah. And as best as I can tell, that works as well as having the card, on the 16-lane bus in the graphics enclosure, because the data that's moving across the bus is not like the...
It's nothing. It's just math problems.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like high bandwidth graphics. So, it doesn't matter that it's constrained to four PCI lanes.
Wow. That is really interesting, and kind of confirms the direction I was thinking about going. By the way, the value of Bitcoin has gone up $100 since we started this conversation. Been watching it. So why don't we transition into eGPUs just for a minute, because this is an area where I am very much living vicariously through you right now, Wimpy. So I really am glad that you were willing to cash in a few Bitcoin to buy these enclosures to do this experimentation under Linux, because since Thunderbolt 3 and USB-C ports were announced, this is where my mind went. One really powerful, or maybe even two, or maybe one day, like USB-C docking stations, Thunderbolt 3 docking stations that have a GPU built in. And I buy two of those. And then from then on, I buy NUCs and I buy laptops with Intel graphics or low-end free AMD graphics Low power, low heat,
easily replaceable,
low cost. Yeah, like I don't invest in this expensive laptop GPU, which inevitably is never as good as a desktop equivalent, and in 2 years is completely out of date. And it would bring life to a whole new category of systems because the GPU would be externalized. So this has been the path that you've gone down, and I've been following it with a lot of interest. And so I take it's going well if you've now bought a second Razer Core. And why the Razer Core?
I got the Razer Core version 1 principally because there was good reports that... So Razer had said, this device works with our line of laptops. And they didn't provide any other compatibility statement. And there were some reports of people plugging this device into some other laptops and not having a good time. But there were also reports that it worked well with the XPS 13 laptop, the XPS 15 laptop, and the Skull Canyon NUC, all of which
is what
I
you
have.
Happen to have.
So it was a low risk, investment in that regard. So that's why I got the Razer Core. It just so happens that it matches the rest of my setup. So the configuration that you describe there is exactly what I have. I have my Skull Canyon NUC here. It's right in front of me. It's a small, reasonably punchy NUC with decent embedded graphics. And then connected to that over Thunderbolt 3, I have the Razer Core V2 currently with the NVIDIA 1080 Ti. And I have two 1440p 27-inch monitors.
Glorious.
I have one of the 27-inch monitors connected to the Razer Core. I've decided to go for a slightly more complex configuration because I'm me. And I have my right-hand monitor is fully accelerated through the 1080 Ti.
Okay.
My left-hand monitor is powered by the IGP on the NUC, but I have one seamless X session.
Okay, I got a lot of questions about that.
And this is quite funky to set up. This is not for the faint of heart, but it is possible.
So how manual of a setup is it, and why did you do it?
I did this so that I could basically push the full power of the 1080 Ti through one screen without reflecting back down what is a constrained connection. So there's four PCI lanes that connect the GPU. And I don't want to be sending data back that is then mirrored out to another display because you bite more performance off the card. So
sounds legit to me.
Yeah. So, but what's fun about this is that if I start a game in a window on the accelerated screen, I can drag it to the not accelerated screen and watch the frame rate drop off a cliff.
I'm impressed that X can even do this. Surprises me.
It's a bit of a trick, and it's borrowing from things like Bumblebee that enable you to do this dynamic allocation of GPU resources, but you're effectively positioning it to a screen, and it works remarkably well. I've had a couple of lockups, but actually none for about a month. So this is
an NVIDIA trick.
Yes, this is using the NVIDIA settings and some manual Xorg magic, yeah.
So for the second eGPU, did you ever consider trying something else like the Alienware eGPU that came out?
I've looked at them, and mainly the reason why I haven't gone down that road is that their power capability, in terms of the power they can deliver to the card, isn't as high as you get with the Razer Core. The Razer Core can go to 375 watts. It's rated at 500 watts and it can peak at 375. This is why I've gone for the RX Vega 56 and not the RX Vega 64, because that will well exceed 375 watts under load, and I just knew that wasn't going to work well.
Have you experimented or dabbled in the, sorry not to interrupt, but I'm just, before we go too far, I know the audience is wondering, have you experimented or dabbled with some of the later AMD cards in that external enclosure?
Only the one that I have, which is the Vega 56. And at the moment that is, I think it's fair to say doesn't work.
Yeah. Right. Specifically in the eGPU. Yeah.
Specifically in the eGPU, yeah. Different kinds of broken. You can sort of coerce it to kind of work, but in general, it doesn't work right now. So I'm tracking, you know, Gitmaster from AMD and testing things out every week or so. It looks close, but if you have it actually, you know, on the bus in a desk side PC, it works just fine.
Last.ting.com. You know you need to check this out. You know, you're looking at your budget, you're like, man, you know what? I could use a new computer. I could use a memory upgrade, a new video card. Well, if I stop paying out the arse for unbelievably crazy wireless plans, I could afford those things. Last.ting.com. A smarter way to do mobile. It's just what you use is what you pay. Minutes, messages, and megabytes. What you use is what you pay. $6 for the line. Then you got Uncle Sam's cut in there. And then that's it. You're done. You know what? If you want to have a couple of phones, it's just $6 for each of them. And then it's just your usage on top of that. Oh, you got Wi-Fi. Well, then you're not using data. You're making calls over Telegram, or you're one of the kids using the WhatsApp out there. You're not using any cellular data, are you? You're on Wi-Fi. It's like you're cheating. It's like you're getting away with something. But it's their business model. You know, they're not out there digging holes in the ground and putting huge towers in and fighting with... You know that they're... You know the Verizon and AT&T, they don't go put towers in themselves. You know, it's not like some division of their company. It's entire businesses that are dedicated to the business of installing cell towers. And I've had one as a client. And you know what the majority of the business is? The legal department. Because they got to interface with the city and the state and the federal level. And they have environmental laws and they have size ordinances. And all these crazy little, like, let's make it look like a tree ordinances that they interface with, and they just, like, offload it to a whole nother – they can't even be bothered to deal with it. And Ting went, like, next level. See, Ting's backed by two cows, so they kind of, like, understand how IP networking works, and they just went next level. And they built, like, a virtual carrier on top of multiple networks, CDMA and GSM. You bring a device because they got tons of device support. Check their BYOD page. And then you'll get a $25 credit, and you can try out Ting for a while. I brought, like, an old clunker just to, like, put my toe in the Ting waters, and then I was blown away. And then they became a sponsor, and now I'm, like, 3 or 4, I don't even know, like, 200 years into using Ting now. I think I've been using Ting longer than they've been Ting. Last.ting.com. At Ethereum on asks, hashtag ask error, what social norm or holiday would you like to skip or not have to participate in at all? And of course, this is rather, as we're recording this, it's pretty close to the core holiday season. We're kind of actually mid-holiday season right now. I'm Wimpy, since you're our guest, I'll let you answer first. What social norm or holiday would you just like to skip out on and participate? And let's just, for additional flavor, say there is no social consequences for it. Like, it's just a get-out-of-jail-free card.
I'd choose Halloween.
Really? I didn't expect Halloween. I didn't. I thought you were going to say Christmas or something like that.
No. I enjoy Christmas because we in our family, we've agreed some years ago that we wouldn't, you know, get carried away with all the presents and things. It really revolves around everyone getting together, enjoying each other's company, cooking good food, drinking good beer, good wine, and playing silly games. So I actually quite enjoy the Christmas holidays.
Oh yeah, that sounds perfect.
Yeah, but Halloween, I actually couldn't care less about that, and it's extremely frustrating, especially, you know, thinking back a few years when you've got young children and people knocking at the door and ringing the doorbell and generally being a pain. And to that end
Do your kids, your young kids didn't do the trick-or-treating at that time? Is that what you mean, like, when they were sleeping?
That's not such a big thing in the UK. The trick and treat, some people participate in that, but Halloween is not the same kind of, you know, celebration that it is in America. It's definitely trending that way, but it's not.
It's gotten bigger. I think Halloween's gotten even bigger here in the last 10 years. It's getting bigger here.
And if there was one other that I could be authoritarian about and be the government for a moment, it would be punishment by death for anyone letting fireworks off in the back of their garden after 8 o'clock in the evening. Because the number of traumatized pets and woken up children and scared children that I've had to deal with over the years as a result of that is just beyond funny. And I love going to an organized fireworks display. It's great. But people setting things off at 11 o'clock at night and midnight is deeply annoying.
Yes, we have a we have a Native American reservation very nearby the studio, and one of their specialties, in fact, one of their biggest sales of the year, is fireworks. That's what they make fireworks that don't have to follow the U.S. government regulations. So the things you might say sell at a stand by a grocery store here in the States have a certain set of regulations and safety requirements they have to follow. Those same regulations do not apply to the tribes. And so they can build fireworks that do much more and boom, much louder. And so everyone in Washington State that knows this comes to the tribe here next to the studio for the 4th of July. And it turns into a war zone. It is a thick, low-hanging smoke that lingers for about 24 hours of sulfur. This experience has sort of moved my needle towards, yeah, I'm more a fan of organized firework events because now every year I have to pull like rockets off my truck and my RV. I have to go off and clean them because the neighborhoods have been for just a solid 12 hours launching fireworks.
People setting off bombs in the street, basically.
Literally just these huge, like, shake your appliances, boom.
And it's not even like, you know, little things. There's like, we have had stuff on top of our roof that people would just set off and it just went wild.
Yeah, and it lands on our roof. And then we either just leave it there or have to go out there and get it.
And hope the roof doesn't catch fire.
Yeah, it's just really bad. So growing up out on a private area on a lake where there was a dozen families and we would light off fireworks over the lake, that was a beautiful fireworks experience. We'd all go to bed at 10 o'clock, call it good, and you'd be done. And that was perfect.
Everybody communally pollutes the lake with their fireworks.
There is that, yeah. And then, you know, you're done with it. But comparatively, it's a tenth of what gets let off around here. So I could agree with you. I just would like to see it dialed down a bit, but I think we're in a particularly bad area for it. Which also makes it a horrible recording week because people around here buy so many fireworks because they get it they don't have to pay taxes on it and they get it at such a great price.
Yeah, they just do it all week.
They do it. It's all week long. It's not just the 4th of July either. It's an entire solid week of fireworks. Well, sometimes 2 weeks.
You need a week to celebrate America.
Yeah, it's the same with Guy Fawkes here. You know, it's weekend to weekend because there are so many organized shows. It spans two weekends. It often falls midweek as well. So,
I feel like you guys got the short end of the stick with that, though, because, like, that's in November. It's not, like, it's way better in the summer.
Yeah, but stuff doesn't burn as much in November.
True.
It's dry here. That's part of the problem. But the Pacific Northwest, we have a lot of dry leaves and branches.
Isn't England, like, always wet, though?
Yeah, well, that's what they say about Seattle.
It wasn't a planned celebration. It was an act of terrorism that led to this.
So what about you, Beard? If you could just wave the wand and no consequences, this holiday vanishes from your life.
Well, it's kind of tricky because I tend to not celebrate most of the holidays anyway, and the people around me don't care either. But back when I was younger, I think the holiday that I would mostly want to get rid of is Easter.
Good choice.
Just because, what's the point?
Yeah, Easter, and it's always like for us, it was always the most like we felt the most obligation to go to the family thing that was too early in the morning, and it was I never enjoyed Easter as a kid.
Yeah, Easter is only it's actually only decent for kids. Like if you're an adult, there's nothing to do.
Yeah, unless you're me, growing up before I was even I think maybe I was in the fifth grade at the latest. I woke up before my kid brother had woken up and apparently before my parents had woken up and they hadn't done anything for Easter. So I got the eggs out and I hid the eggs and then I went back and that was the Easter. And then my brother woke up and we went and hunted for eggs before my parents even woke up. Yep. And that was the Easter I realized there's no Easter bunny. Sorry, spoiler alert. All right. Well, boy, this has been a couple of downers. Let's see. I feel like I should rep like the people in the audience that would like to get rid of Christmas right now. I know for me, ever since I vowed to never put Christmas presents on a credit card, it takes me, and since I've been a podcaster, it takes me months to recover from Christmas. just because I'm separated from Angela and we're divorced and the kids live with her primarily, but they see me, you know, a few times a week. But like when it comes to Christmas, like I don't want to disappoint because that's like, you know, I feel like I barely get to see them and give them enough as it is. So I'm always really sort of, there's always this sort of like demon in the back of my head that's saying like, well, you know, they really want this and be really great if, you know, you can't be there all the time, but at least you could give them this. So I have to sort of like temper that with the fact that I'm broke. And sort of walk that line really closely. So Christmas is definitely a source of a lot of stress for me. But if I could, you know, as the kids get older, if I could convert Christmas more into like what Wimpy's described, then that would be, I don't think I'd want to get rid of that holiday. I think I would want to keep that holiday. And then I think what I'd want to do is, and maybe I'm bending the rules here of the Ask Air question, but I'd like to wave my wand and I'd like to strike out all of the corporate holidays, like Valentine's and Father's Day and Mother's Day, although I still like Father's Day and Mother's Day, but you know what I mean? Like all of the ones that require you to go get like flowers or cards in the middle of your workday.
Mother's Day is an interesting one. And every year I haven't learned, at the age of 45, I still haven't learned this. The Mother's Day in the UK is a different day, like months apart from Mother's Day in America. And I do my thing. I buy flowers and a card and phone my mum and do all of those good things that a son's supposed to do. And then months later, have a heart-in-mouth moment when Twitter is full of, it's Mother's Day. And I think, shit, I've forgotten. And then I realise, it's America only. So Mother's Day, if there was just like global harmonisation of when Mother's Day was exactly, that would be helpful.
Sync it up. Yeah, geez, that does sound awful.
No, see, what you do is you just do both. And then she feels extra special.
Well, then you're really the son of the year, aren't you? Yeah, like I wouldn't take out Mother's Day, but I wish I could sort of de-corporatize the whole thing. Valentine's Day and Easter's getting there. You know, like there's these holidays that I feel like some U.S. marketing corporation back in the 1930s and 1920s successfully introduced into the American culture and lexicon, and now all of a sudden, all these years later, I'm stuck following this stupid thing that's just designed to boost up Hallmark sales.
You know the worst thing about Easter is the candy that is okay on Easter. It's like the lowest quality candy you can
ever get. You're talking about Peeps?
Peeps, like Easter chocolate is the worst chocolate ever.
That weird off chocolate that's hollow too. Like they give you a hollow. Whenever is a hollow chocolate bar okay? When is that ever okay? You know, but on Easter, it's like no big deal. But, oh, yeah, well, it's a fucking bunny, so that's fine.
You get conditioned to the hollow chocolate quite early on, but I can remember as a child, about five
like,
or
what
six,
is this?
Seeing these things, thinking, oh, my goodness, look at this. Look at how much chocolate I'm about to get. And then the crushing disappointment when you find out it's this wafer-thin bit of chocolate with maybe a few toffees inside. It's like, well, that isn't what I was signing up for.
If you're lucky... Toffee, if you are lucky, toffee would be a premium product.
I found an end around that. I asked for the white chocolate bunny because bunnies are white and they're almost always full.
Solid, yeah. The white ones are. But, you know, the problem is the Easter white chocolate is not like your good luxury white chocolate. Like, I have come across some white chocolate in my travels that made me rethink my relationship with chocolate. And I'll tell you, that stuff is nearly plastic that comes like in that foil wrapper.
It's still better than the regular chocolate, though.
Yeah, that's, I suppose you might be right. At least it's solid.
Your remarks about the quality of chocolate are interesting because having traveled to America for many times over the years, I identify with, you know, the cheap chocolate that you get in some of these mass-produced things. We don't have that over here. We only have really good chocolate. So although it's thin, it is at least decent. So there is that at least to be thankful for.
That doesn't surprise me. You know, here it is a rarity. So if you're traveling somewhere, it might actually be like one of the main attractions of the town is that they have a decent place that makes chocolate. That would be like on Yelp as a unique thing about that town is there's one spot where you can get decent chocolate. That's how it is here in the States.
I will say about the corporate holidays, though, I agree with getting rid of all of them, especially the ones that are focused around love, because that implies a lot of obligation.
It's a lot of pressure.
Instead, I think there should just be like one day a month that's set aside for celebrating whatever kind of love you want.
Ooh.
And that sounds like really hippie.
That's some free hippie stuff there, man. I like it. I like that. Okay. So like a new holiday.
Yeah.
We could call it Festivus.
You take the money you would spend Festivus. You'd spend over Valentine's Day and spread it out over a year.
So we had a – I can't find it now, but we had an Ask Air question that came in, and it went something like this. Hashtag Ask Air. If you could go back in time, only back in time, what period would you go to?
So I was born in the early 1970s. So I got to experience some of the 1970s growing up, and I can remember it. And in some respects, it was a pretty dismal time in the UK in the 1970s. But in terms of fashion and music, it was a really energetic period in sort of British culture. And I would like to go back and be in a position where I'm young enough to be able to experience the 1970s to the full and everything that art and fashion and music had to offer at that time. Maybe I'm looking back with rose-tinted glasses to some extent, but I have real nostalgia for the 1970s.
I like that. And if only you could bring your smartphone with an offline copy of Wikipedia, you'd basically be set, Wimpy.
Yep.
DigitalOcean.com. Go to DigitalOcean.com, create your account, and then use our promo code of authority and power. Here's the thing. All one word, you smash it in that box, you apply it to your account, and you get $10 of credit. Oh, $10! That's so fancy! Don't be a noob. Go to DigitalOcean.com and look at their pricing. Now, y'all know my favorite machine is 3 cents an hour because I like performance. 2 gigs of RAM, 2 CPUs, 40 gigabytes of that SSD. It's all SSD goodness over there at DigitalOcean.com, and 3 terabytes of transfer. Now, they got a machine as low as $5 a month. Now you get the $10 credit, right? Use the promo code Here's the Thing. You get the $10 credit, and then you make a server anywhere in the world because they got data centers all over the place. It's pretty great. They got Amsterdam, Germany, Singapore, London, Toronto, New York City, San Francisco, and then they have like multiple data centers in some of those cities too. It's so cool because then you can, with one button, deploy an entire stack of like GitLab, Ubuntu, and all that stuff, or just deploy a bare system or even FreeBSD. And you can get started in less than 55 seconds. If you want to go boss level, they have a very simple API you can use to manage all of this stuff. Lots of open source code is already written. It's good stuff. And they have a frequently asked question they just posted a few days ago about using private networking. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about private networking. I mean, I don't talk about it enough, but it's really cool. It's a great feature of DigitalOcean. If you've got more than a couple of rigs, you might want to check it out. And they just posted like a few days ago a frequently asked questions in their community section. Start by going to DigitalOcean.com and then use our promo code. Here's the thing. You get a $10 credit. You support user air. And more importantly, you can mess around with like that $5 rig 2 months for free. DigitalOcean.com. Promo code. Here's the thing. I'd like to hear Wimpy's opinion on this next story because this is, I don't know, this feels like some guy out of Texas, but it actually is Florida. It is Florida. When you hear the story.
Florida man?
It's a total Florida man story. Here you go. I'll set it up for you. A Miami man took extra care to make sure his end-of-life medical treatment went according to his wishes. He had the words, "Do not resuscitate," tattooed on his chest. The black, bold, capital letters were in plain sight on his collarbone, and the word "not" was underlined for good measure, and then the man's own signature was reproduced under the "Do Not Resuscitate" tattoo. Well, you can probably guess where this is going. So the guy gets this tattoo ages ago. Now he's 70 years old, and he ends up in the hospital. And doctors need to resuscitate him. And they go pull open his shirt to give him the, you know, the old paddles or whatever. And he's got this "Do Not Resuscitate" with the "not" underlined and his signature on there. And they go, "Well, shit, now what do we do?" Like, this is like out of like a television show. But this really happened. The New York Times will be linked in the show notes. I guess the man had a history of lung disease, heart problems, and diabetes. And he was admitted to the Jackson Memorial Hospital this year. He was unconscious and did not have any identification. And his blood alcohol level was high. According to a letter that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine on Thursday, doctors administered some treatment, but the man never became responsive enough to speak. And while the message of the tattoo was clear, doctors had no way of knowing whether getting it had been an impulsive decision. So they had to consult an ethics expert while this guy's dying on the table, who advised them to honor the man's apparent wishes. The doctor stopped short of administering the most invasive forms of life-saving treatment and the man's health deteriorated until he died.
But they respected his wishes.
Yeah. Supposedly, a social worker later on found some paperwork that did say he didn't want to be resuscitated. Conveniently, right before he died, they happened to find that paperwork at his house. But it is actually kind of an interesting conversation, they say. There is an impasse that doctors haven't figured out how to cross here. They say in the United States, people have the right to ask not to be resuscitated in the event of a medical emergency. But the doctors don't really know. There's no way to communicate to them if you haven't filled out paperwork or there's not something on there. And so there's a growing movement to improve the way that doctors and patients communicate about end-of-life care. But there's still a long way to go, mostly because a lot of folks are reluctant to talk about morality with their friends and family, which is kind of necessary for this process. So the question is how do you properly communicate to doctors that if you go into the hospital, you don't want to be resuscitated?
A subdermal ID chip.
Okay, how do you do it without implanting tracking chips on humans? What do you think, Wimpy? Is there another problem, or another solution to this problem?
So one of the things they're introducing in this country is to not make donor cards mandatory, but to encourage that they're more widely carried. And I imagine that, you know, if there was enough of a movement around that, and this is obviously for organ harvesting in the event of your death, you know, there could be that could be co-opted for other purposes, such as, you know, do not resuscitate scenarios as well.
Interesting. You know, is it crazy to put it on the phone? Here, follow me here for a second, because almost everybody you're going to bring in, if they have a wallet and whatnot on them, they'll probably have their phone. And on Apple iPhones, there's a function in the health app, and it also works for the watch, where you can put a medical alert for EMTs and doctors. Like, I am allergic to penicillin. I have diabetes. And there is a way for people that are administering emergency medical care for you to retrieve that card and pull it up on your iPhone without unlocking it. And it's all user controlled. It's all, you know, you go through the right security processes and it's clearly defined to the user what will be displayed. And the entire purpose is for it to be an emergency medical ID. And, you know, if Google were to implement something like that and could do it securely, then, you know, that would be almost halfway, more than halfway there, that people could just have this information on their phone and you could tap it up. And one of the options could be do not resuscitate or please donate my organs. I mean, I know this sounds crazy to us who are security minded, but I think of my kids that are going to grow up with mobile devices in their life, and they're going to have all kinds of information. They'll put all kinds of stuff in there. What do you think, Beard? Am I crazy, or would it work like that?
I mean, I think it would work like that, but I also think that it's not going to solve these kinds of situations. Like, if you don't have your ID, how likely are you to have your phone?
Yeah, I mean, me personally, I have left my house plenty of times without my wallet, but I always have my phone. Because I got to listen to a podcast, so.
Yeah, I think you're in a bit of a bubble, Chris.
Yeah, I know. I know, but it does seem like it could be at least another tool.
Another tool, yeah, because although smartphones are commonplace in the circles we move in.
Yes, right.
It's not lingua franca for, you know, technology for everybody in all of society.
Well, this is where dog tags come from, right? I mean, you could have tags on.
Yeah, like Rikai says, you know, implants and things. But then we start getting into really uncomfortable territory. You know, I'm not like a massive privacy advocate. It's something that I think about and I consider. But I wouldn't be comfortable about carrying medical data in an app on my phone or having an implant that, you know, carries personal information about myself. I'm also quite... uncertain about where we're going with the increasing use of biometrics as well. I worry that in a dystopian future this will lead to a wide outbreak of violent crime, as the only way that you're able to you know, access privileged information is to do you know, actual bodily harm or grievous bodily harm to, you know, the victim of your you know, malcontent.
Like take their finger or something like that.
Yeah, what if only thing the ID chip has is like a DNR order?
A code or something. Like a code that you look up on a blockchain.
It doesn't tell you who the person is. It just says, do not resuscitate. Because it's a very low likelihood that somebody is going to attack you implant a chip in you to say not to resuscitate you and then let you go.
Yeah,
Has this Florida man not hit on the solution, though, which is if you are a do not resuscitate
tattoo it and sign it.
Just have it tattooed somewhere.
Perhaps, yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say, yeah.
The problem is anybody can get a tattoo whenever they want.
But I could tell you what the problem is with even a chip that just transmit do not resuscitate. It would have to be something that was a unique identifier that they would, you know, think about the way the medical system would work. You would scan it. It would come up and say, yeah, this is patient such and such. They subscribed to this on X and X date. They purchased it. It was installed by such and such doctor. This is verified by the Life Trust Corporation that this is all, you know, all that would be part of the process. And the issue is anything embedded in your body that's transmitting an ID can be used to track you by scanners. So even if they're not reading what the data is, if it's just like being able to track your MAC address of your Wi-Fi or your Bluetooth radio. You know what I mean? So it's another element to track your movements,
I suppose.
That's dystopian, though, if you think about it. It makes it sound like, I don't know, I have a friend who does have RFID chips implanted in his hands. And he spent, in both hands.
Why?
He has spent a decade now retrofitting everything in his life. His computer, his car, his house, his office. Everything identifies him by his hands, and they unlock or they log in for him or they activate, depending. I mean, it's so many things that he's one of those guys who can – he'll take apart something and rewire it and resolder it so that way he can add in an RFID scanner and make it automated. So he's hacked it onto stuff that you normally wouldn't have automated, and he advocates it. He's a big fan of it, and he's been interviewed quite a bit about it. And
there's a lot of body hackers out there.
Yeah. Yeah,
interesting. Yeah. If anyone has never read these books, I suggest you look up some of the short stories by William Gibson, who goes into some of this, you know, body hacking stuff. My mind is just cast back to some of those stories, you know, burning chrome and what have you.
I mean, isn't there something to be said for getting into that stuff ahead of like the corporations to make sure it's implemented in a consumer friendly way?
As if it's, in other words, it's coming anyways.
Yeah,
I suppose.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you want to know how it works. You want to have people that are out there that are at the ground level of the technology, and they're advocates because they understand how it works, I guess. But I'm not a big fan of putting anything in my body that depends on any kind of external infrastructure to work. So it may be the coolest thing for 25 years to be able to have your entire house and unlock your car and log into your computer with your hands. And then what happens in year 28 when that stuff doesn't work for whatever reason? Things have moved on. The operating system hooks are no longer there. You got a new car. You moved houses. Then all of a sudden you have these things in your hands that are not nearly as useful as they once were, and they never go away.
I mean, they also are designing things that will degrade in your body over time, so they kind of just go away on their own.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, there is something I would be willing to put in my body for a short period of time, and that is a glucose tracker. Where if I could, there are ones today you can get that are they sound gross to me. It's the size of a pill with a really long tail, mm-hmm. like something from the Matrix, and you inject it into your belly fat, and then the coil, the long wire acts as the transmitter, and then you pair it to like an Apple Watch or an internet phone or an Android phone, and it does a continuous monitoring of your blood sugar levels and transmits it to your phone.
Actually, extremely useful data.
Extremely useful data. I feel like I could change my life if I could watch that more closely. So I would be willing if there was a way to like swallow a pill and have it work its way through my system every 3 days or something like that. I might be up for something like that.
What if it were like something tiny that were a shot instead? Just do it once.
Well, right. Yeah, maybe. What's the difference between that and say like an IUD or a pacemaker, right? Yeah. That is
or taking insulin.
That's an uncanny valley we have crossed before, but that's a good question. I don't know. You have any closing thoughts on that topic, Wimpy, before we move on to one last Ask Air?
Nothing more from me.
All right. So last Ask Air for the show. Now, this is how you get yours onto the show. Hashtag Ask Error in either Discord or in Telegram on our Jupiter Broadcasting Telegram group or on Twitter, which is the way I usually check. Is just, you can just say it. You don't have to tag us if you don't want. Although now that you have more character, you might as well. So then at least we see it. So, hashtag Ask Air, what are some red flags that we should recognize within ourselves? What are things that we should recognize within ourselves? Flaws that are like red flags, like if you're checking yourself before you wreck yourself. And I will start with just one that I'm struggling with right now as we record this episode. We're rebooting the TechSnap program, and we're re-engineering the entire back end of the show. We're considering we've already made the decision by the time this episode comes out, but we're considering redoing the music, and it's a total change in tone. And I have found myself reiterating over it and questioning myself over and over and over again. And I've probably iterated on this music 30 times, and I'm still not super happy with it. And so I find myself wanting to seek out like external validation. Hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? And it never goes the way I want it to, but yet I still seek it out for some reason. And that to me would be a red flag. Like, what's going on there? Just make a decision and go with it. And you can always change it later would be the more like I would feel like sane person approach to that
problem.
Grab
your sack and go, Chris.
But instead I'm like, hey, so what do you think of this? Hey, what do you, hey, can I play this for you and get your opinion on this? Which I think is probably a bad sign, something I need to not necessarily stop doing, but just dial back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my sort of red flag that I've noticed within myself recently. Mr. Wimpress, do you have anything to share with the class? Anything to confess?
Oh, wow. Where do I start?
Go ahead, my son. Go ahead.
I have quite a compulsive nature. And when I get into something, it's very difficult for me to not do the thing that I enjoy. So, not so long ago, I started playing Rust, as you know. And that became a really engrossing thing for me, where when I would finish work in the evenings, I'd do my jobs around the house, and then I would play Rust until 2 or 4 o'clock in the morning for, you know, several weeks on the bounce, because I was really enjoying that. But this can overlap into, you know, programming projects that I might set myself, or jobs around the house, or anything. You know, I can throw myself into things almost at the exclusion of everything else.
Yeah. I have found that to be a good attribute of mine, and one that also sometimes has to be governed as well.
Yeah, I also have that issue. Yeah. I think that's just a human thing.
It depends. I think it's probably more common in geeks, don't you think?
Yeah.
You get obsessive about sci-fi or computers or programming. Like, you get all raptured up, whatever.
We have a tendency to hyper-focus.
Enraptured, that's what I'm thinking of, or whatever it's called. That's you know what? That sounds like a very common one, Wimpy, and I agree. That's something we all kind of have to watch out for. All right, get your question into the show, hashtag Ask Air. Let us know. Beard, is there anything else you wanted to add before we...
I find that I tend to create excuses to be sedentary.
Hmm.
Like, there's always something I can be doing, so it's always an excuse to not, like, go out and exercise or go for a walk or all that stuff, and I really need to stop that.
Yeah, and the hardest part is, it's funny, like, when you're not, because I experience this in a super concentrated form when I'm driving the RV for, like, hours and hours, is about 6 hours into driving, 6 hours straight of driving. You would think I would want to jump up and want to run around and exercise my legs, but I want to move less and less. After I've been sitting for 6 hours, the last thing I want to do, for whatever reason, is get up and move around. And, you know, Hadia, or if we're with the kids, like, they want to get out and they want to move, and they literally want to go bring a Bluetooth speaker and dance outside. And I'm like, I don't want to move my legs.
If anything, you want to lay down, take a nap.
Absolutely. That's exactly how I would feel, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's funny, because the way to stay active is by being active. And if you're inactive, you remain inactive. But it's such a catch-22, because it means at some point you just have to go do something you don't want to do at all.
Yep.
And it's like, well, shit, I got enough of that. Like, I don't really need more of things I don't want
to
do.
The only way to really solve that is to, like, make it so stupidly easy to do that you feel bad for not doing it.
Yeah, or get into something like geocaching or something like that that just gives you some sort of geeky excuse to get out there. But that kind of, you know, sucks when it's 30 degrees outside and stuff like that. That's not as awesome. But yeah, that's a good one too.
Is geocaching still a thing?
You know, surprisingly, it's still got a small little active community, at least around here. Although Washington's sort of famous for like hikes and trails and all that, so it may be a little more popular here than other places. That's sort of our bag here. I've tried it a little bit with the kids, and they love it. They think it's the coolest thing to find like this little mystery box of stuff, and then you know they bring a little trinket to leave behind and whatnot. It's for them. It's a pretty good motivator to keep moving on a walk too.
Mm-hmm. So that's nice. I nearly fell off my chair recently when my wife said to me, "Do I know about geocaching and should we go and do some?" And I was like, "Where on earth did you hear about geocaching?"
Right.
Yeah. Okay. We can do that. That falls in the subscribed, you know, geeky things to do. We can totally do that.
It's so much cooler now than when when my dad and I got into it, you know, the best you had were these large handheld monochrome Garmin GPS devices that just give you basic direction. And then you'd have to input coordinates that you got off of some basic HTML website.
And now you have these large handheld inaccurate GPSs in your phone.
Yeah, but it still gives the hunt aspect to it. You know, so you have the app. It can find all of them around you. And they have ones that are specifically apps for families, so you can get the difficulty and people leave reviews now. It's geocaching. I tinkered with it when it was first sort of when handheld GPSs became a consumer achievable thing. You know, you still had to go to like a hiking store. The one around here is called REI. I went to REI and I had to buy like a $180 mid-grade GPS unit, and that was how I was able to geocache. And now it's you can just do it from your phone, and there's so many apps that curate it all. It is, if you just need some excuse. The other thing that you know you might consider doing, Beard, if it comes up on sale, this may or may not work for you, is I find that even though I would like to say I'm smarter than this, I do find that having a fitness tracker on my wrist that gives me prompts in a nice like sort of, hey, you know, so here's what I have on my watch face. I don't have it right now because it's not the evening. But tonight when I go home, there's a little card that will show up on my watch and it will say, hey, you know, if you took a 20-minute walk, if you went for a 20-minute walk right now, you would complete your fitness goal for the day. You just have to go for a 20-minute walk. And more times than not, I look down at that and I go, yeah, what am I doing, watching TV? Yeah, I could go for a 20-minute walk. And then I end up going for a 45-minute walk. And there is a little gamification to it. You can do it with Fitbits. You can do it with, you know, Android Wear. You can do it with the Apple Watch. And it kind of works. It's like it's just like it's not like it's like it's oh man, I got to close those rings. At the same time, it's like, yeah, you know, I would like to kind of feel good about doing that. And I could take 20 minutes.
I did get kind of into jogging for a little while because of that zombie run game. Mm. Just because zombies.
Yeah, zombies. That's another good way. All right, get your questions into the show. Hashtag Ask Air. I've heard bits and pieces of Wimpy's Linux setup over the years, but I thought maybe we'd take a second here in the show and get like a consolidated update on the Martin Wimpress Linux setup. And I know a lot of it's positioned around, a NUC, which I think a lot of people would be like, a NUC? Wimpy uses a NUC? What are you, crazy?
I do, yeah. So, yeah, I mentioned earlier that my main computer is the Intel Skull Canyon NUC. Which came out about 18 months ago now, I think, May 2016. That's
sounds
got
right.
6770HQ quad-core 8-thread Intel processor in it. It has 32 gigs of DDR4 RAM, and it has two 1-terabyte NVMe disks in RAID Stripe.
Wow.
It's got Intel Iris Pro embedded graphics, and thanks to the wonders of Thunderbolt 3, it has an NVIDIA 1080 Ti connected to it. And then for, you know, podcasting and such, I also have a Focusrite Scarlett Solo connected to that as my audio interface. And connected to that, I have external speakers and wireless headphones and the Yeti Pro connected via XLR, and I have a gaming keypad in addition to a DAS keyboard and a Razer. Which one is this? It's a Razer mouse. It's the Lancehead Tournament Edition mouse. So yeah, quite the setup, and I love this arrangement. Two monitors.
Yeah, that sounds really nice. Two monitors, okay.
Yep.
Are they both horizontal, or do you have one turned?
No, they're panoramic, so they're two 27-inch 1440p monitors.
So
quite the wide display, and naturally it's running Ubuntu Mate 1804 daily.
Of course, 1804, of course. So I have, you mentioned you have an XLR microphone. How do you bring an XLR connection into that NUC? What's the interface there?
So the Focusrite Scarlett Solo USB
interface. It has the XLR plug.
Yeah, and that has the XLR plug on it. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah, that's a great setup. Wow, I love that. And then I know you also pack a couple of laptops, because I know you're constantly testing stuff on those laptops. So are those nearby? How's that? What's that setup?
So I think at the last count, I've got 11 laptops.
You beat me! Wow!
Of various vintages. The ones that I use most regularly. So I have three XPS 13 laptops. One that I have loaned to Mark, who's co-host on the Ubuntu podcast. I have an Entroware Athena that Popey's currently borrowing. I have an XPS 13 for my wife, another one for myself, an XPS 15, and I have an Entroware Apollo, which is exclusively for running Solason for the times that Ikey and I collaborate on stuff. And I have an HP, what's it called now? That sexy one.
Right. Yeah.
Spectre 13.
Spectre.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then a host of ThinkPads, and then a bunch of single board computers with things like the Next Dock to convert those into laptop type form factors. So a whole host of laptop stuff. Yeah,
that's I love those. I can't remember the Motorola one, but producer Q5 says
the Atrix laptop.
That
I have
dock,
two of those as well.
Oh, you do. Those are the best for working with like Raspberry Pi type setups. Those are so great. And that battery power can power the Pi too.
It can.
I love that. So this is a pretty solid setup, but I bet like me, you're already kind of looking towards 2018. That NUC's a pretty nice NUC, but rumor has it there's a new one in the works that I bet you have your eye on.
I really do. So yeah, the replacement for the NUC that I have is going to be called the Hades Canyon NUC, and it looks like that's going to be released in sort of Q2 2018. And this is going to feature this new collaboration between Intel and AMD, where you have an Intel IGP on the CPU, but also on the same package, you'll have AMD GPU as well. Mm-hmm. And reading between the lines, nothing's set in stone at the moment, but reading between the lines, to give you an idea, it looks very much like the kind of power that's going to be in the AMD component of this package is going to be along the lines of what the Xbox One S can do in terms of, you know, graphics performance. So this is going to be probably quite a competent 1080p GPU. I'm looking interested to see, you know, where that goes. But also it has two Thunderbolt 3 ports on the back of it.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
So this is the NUC to have. Yeah, I'm looking at an Extreme Tech article that I'll have linked in the show notes. Yeah, and they talk about the TDP headroom that's basically left over for the GPU. So from that, you can essentially do the math and figure out how much power the GPU gets, which it does look like it's better than just an embedded Intel. See, what I was thinking was you'd have a situation where you had the Intel graphics, and then you'd have a dedicated AMD GPU that's built in that essentially would be good for OpenCL and rendering a video, but probably not much better than that. But this is actually looking like I may be a little pessimist here, because this is like a mid-level, probably like a, I don't know, what would you say, Wimpy? Maybe equivalent to like a 1050, a 1060. I don't know what's the mid-range of the NVIDIA?
I think it's going to, you know, it's difficult to tell. I think it said it's going to have 12 compute units on it, which is about Xbox One S. So yeah, around that sort of 1050 Ti sort of area, but we won't know for sure until it comes out.
This could be a jungle of video cards, though. You know what I'm saying? You could have a jungle here because you have the Intel graphics, then you're going to have the AMD graphics, and then you're going to have an NVIDIA card hooked up over Thunderbolt.
Well, see, with Wimpy, he said there's two Thunderbolt ports, so I'm waiting for the external GPU SLI.
I don't know if that's possible.
you play Rust on one eGPU, and you mine Ethereum on the other eGPU. That's it.
or something that I've been experimenting with recently is there's a snap of FFmpeg, which has got the NVIDIA CUDA SDK integrated. So you can now do hardware-assisted video encoding on this external GPU. And to give you an idea, the sample video that I'm encoding, which is several minutes of HD footage, it can encode in 3 seconds, which is pretty good. Ooh. And doing it on the CPU is around 37 seconds. So that's quite the saving.
Yes. Oh, boy. I can't wait to play with that. Oh, yeah. This is my 2018 goal in life is to hopefully be able to hopefully Bitcoin keeps going up, because I'd like to get a little NUC, just a reasonable NUC and an external GPU enclosure, and I'd basically replicate a setup like yours around the Hades NUC, because that's my I have two 27-inch monitors. I have one that's horizontal and one that's vertical, and I just love that resolution. 2K screens each of them, and it's so perfect on Linux.
I think 1440p is the sweet spot for many things. It's perfect for the Linux desktop because you don't have to get into the whole high DPI dance, but you do get lots of usable resolution. So let me explain. If you've got a single 1440p monitor, it's the equivalent of 4 720p displays in that screen.
So that's a great way to put it.
If you tile your windows to quadrants, each window is 720p. So when you think about what was common for laptops, 5 years or so ago, that it's effectively that resolution four times. And then for gaming as well, when you've got a higher end card like the 1080 Ti, 1440p is really the 1080 Ti can run that, comfortably all the live long day. When you take titles like F1 2017 with its Vulkan support now, it's quite astonishing at what that's capable of, pushing out. And I know it can do it at 4K, but it starts to hit the edges of what's possible. But 1440p is the place to be, in my opinion.
I will say that there is better than 1440p on Linux, and that is, technically it's still 1440 horizontal, but it's ultra wide.
Yeah.
Oh, like this screen we have here. We do have this LG super ultra wide that we run for our OBS rig, and that's my favorite monitor in the studio.
Or like the absurd one that I just bought.
Yeah. Yeah, you got a great Black Friday monitor that's crazy wide.
Currently the best computer in the studio is mine, and it runs Linux.
And that is a nice screen. If I'm shopping for myself, 2K is where I go. If I'm shopping for friends or family that don't have super high requirements, for most of them, I'm still getting 1080p displays because that's just a sweet point. And for them, the text being a little bit larger on the screen is actually a benefit typically.
And the other good thing about going 2K or 4K is if you're into the Linux gaming, you can do stuff like G-Sync and FreeSync and push it higher than 60 hertz as well.
Now that would be an experience.
The two of you have just mentioned so many things. I've got opinions on there.
Oh, really? Go ahead. I'd love to hear it. Yeah.
So I agree. On laptops, I've had laptops. I do have laptops that have high DPI screens. But recently I have not been buying high DPI laptops. I've been going for 1080p laptops. I still think that is the perfect resolution for laptops. And it really comes down to, battery endurance. As soon as you start getting those higher resolutions, you really, pay a tax in terms of battery endurance, and battery endurance is more important to me than high DPI screens. And then what was the other point you were making?
Ultra wide.
Ultra wide. I've kind of substituted a single ultra wide for two monitors
to create
an ultra wide, panoramic view.
Was it G-Sync?
G-Sync and FreeSync. How have we arrived at this situation where we've got AMD and FreeSync and NVIDIA and G-Sync, and now we've got these two incompatible protocols for handling dynamic frame rates.
It's because they took two completely different approaches. Like, NVIDIA's is hardware-based. That's why it's more expensive. And then AMD went the software route.
It's interesting. I feel that maybe FreeSync is going to win out. And I say this purely because the Xbox and the PlayStation have AMD graphics in them, and therefore that's going to become what set manufacturers, you know, gravitate towards.
I mean, you say that, but I believe the Nintendo has NVIDIA graphics in it.
The thing is that the G-Sync monitors are all outside my price range. That's my problem. Is I would, if I could get a monitor with G-Sync, I would do it because I have an NVIDIA card. But they're all like above my price point.
You can get them for like $300 now.
Yeah, that's kind of pushing it. I don't know. Yeah, I'm kind of exhausted by it. I want that feature, the syncing feature, but I'm like with Wimpy. I'm just really frustrated that in 2017 we still have this problem. It feels like this is a problem of the 90s, and it's just frustrating. It's like DirectX OpenGL at every single little turn. I just want to be able to, if I'm going to do PC gaming, I just want to be able to invest in a good monitor and a good PC tower. And then I would like to be able to get 5 years at least out of the main rig, and maybe 2-3 years out of the, maybe 2 years. Let's say it's dedicated for gaming and the VR that Wimpy doesn't believe in. I would like 2 years out of the graphics card, and I would like 5 years out of the motherboard. And I'd like to be able to add RAM to it. I'd like to be able to add additional faster storage later on if I want. And I want to be able to buy one monitor to last the tower that entire time, because at least so far in my life, like a lot of times my monitors outlast my PCs 2x. And so I just don't like this. Now I'm going to buy a monitor the one time that supports one thing, and then maybe later I'll get a video card that's implementing over software that then has this additional downside to it. None of this is appealing to me, and it pushes me towards things like the Nintendo Switch. It really does. And I've been a PC gamer my entire life. And this is just one thing. The transition to Vulkan I'm excited about. In the meantime, I'm sick of waiting. I'm sick of waiting for the year of Linux gaming. There's like, I have the desktop games I want to play are there, but I'm sick of fiddling with it. I had a, as much as Wimpy and I both, Wimpy loves Rust. He turned me on to it. I love it. But I had one of these experiences where I'm on a MiFi connection, and it was a particularly bad day. And I open up Steam to play Rust, but of course, first there is a mandatory update. It's 140 megabytes. Well, in this particular day, that means it's going to take 30 minutes to download. Well, I had just grabbed Dylan, and we were just trying to do something. We had 15 minutes to play. So then I'm like, okay, well, let's do Rocket League. Well, nope. Mandatory update. 280 megabytes. And damn it. You know, I was like, I just wanted to sit down and just have a console-like experience, because this Linux box is running Ubuntu LTS. It's got a great graphics card in it. It's a super rock-solid setup. It was like a solid gaming machine for 3 weeks straight. And then randomly, one afternoon where I get 15 minutes, I sit down and, nope, sorry, you can't play your games.
Well, the thing is, you say that's a PC issue. You're going to encounter that with consoles too, you know.
Yeah, I suppose it does happen more now.
So I've gone completely the other direction, which is I've never been much of a gamer, but I've had consoles since the PS1 as the thing that I play games on. So if I wanted to play games, I had a PlayStation of some description in order to play games. But since Steam came to Linux and my PS3 overheated and died, I didn't replace that with a PlayStation or an Xbox. I have just invested in Steam because, frankly, my wife has no interest in playing games. My daughter's just getting to the point where she's interested in playing games now. And I've become a PC gamer, and more so in the last couple of months. I now actually have, I think, what is described in air quotes as a gaming chair, and I have a specially adapted gaming keypad for my right hand, so that I have WASD in the right place. I have a gaming mouse now, and a whole bunch of other paraphernalia that gamers have, including a mouse called Bungie. You know, this is how far it's come.
Very good.
But where's your Vive?
Well, you know, don't my get opinion on VR.
Let's. mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you've got a that's pretty good.
But see, as a console gamer that became a PC gamer, I have hope for you that you'll become a VR gamer someday.
He's not all in on that. I'll tell you that.
I do look at the Vive from time to time, and I could, you know, the investment that I've made in graphics card and Razer cores this year, the escalating price of Bitcoin means that would be something I could afford to do, but I just can't. I can't emotionally get myself across the line that this is a thing that I want. I just feel like there is nothing new about VR. There is nothing compelling about it. It's not a new idea. Nobody's innovating. Nobody's creating anything that says to me, I want to use VR. And I feel bad about this because one of my friends, his daughter and my daughter play in the same in American soccer team on a Sunday morning. And he works for, I try not to betray confidences. He works for a company that rhymes with bony, and he may or may not be involved as the principal engineer for the operating system that runs on Bony's line of games consoles. So we have some very interesting conversations and exchanges about the state of VR in the world. And even Bony are struggling to actually come up with platform shifting technologies and titles and innovations.
Mm. Well, I can't believe we actually did it. We actually talked about VR. I was going to avoid it the whole show.
We did. All right.
It's all Rikai's fault.
You know what? This mouse bungee you got, this is a serious piece of hardware. This is no joke. Like, I pictured something, like a little pig's tail on your cord, but this is like an apparatus for avoiding mouse entanglement.
Yep.
I'm impressed. You are really dedicated to this. This is a serious piece of equipment. I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes.
Connected to my 16,000 DPI mouse that you have to turn the sensitivity way down to the smallest fraction above zero so you can use it on the desktop.
Well, there you go. That's
the mouse bungee. That's actually very useful day to day. It's not just a game.
I think so.
Yeah.
I was looking at that thinking, I kind of want one even if I'm not gaming.
You know what I did? I went a completely different direction, and I just got a dual mode wireless mouse.
Dual mode?
Yeah.
Oh, so like it's
so
like,
if you plug it in, it's charging and doing data over the cable.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But if you unplug it,
so
it's
this
wireless.
Combats potential latency by having it in wired when you need that performance, is this
yep.
right?
Oh, okay. And it charges it, I assume.
Yeah, it's the Logitech G700S.
I think I used to have a mouse that did
I'm
that.
Slightly encumbered when it comes to choosing mice because I'm left-handed. So if I want a mouse, I have to go for one that has, you know, neutral sculpting.
I'm left-handed, but I've adapted to the right-handed master race.
Mm.
So you, just use a sculpted mouse for the right hand, or
yep.
you use your right hand?
I use my right hand.
Oh, right, okay. No, I'm not prepared to do that.
So that is a new trick you'd have to learn there. That's it.
Well, see, I had to get used to it because back in the day,
oh yeah,
you didn't have sculpted mice.
Yeah, there was way less options. You had some basic ones.
Yep.
Basic. Well, Wimpy, thank you. That's a good tour of the setup. Wimpy just mentioned a few moments ago about growing up in the 70s, and this story for me has a special like way I remember it, and it is this was the big space initiative that launched right before I was born. So this thing and I are sort of the same age, and so it's interesting to sort of I've been tracking this thing since I've been aware and realized, oh my gosh, this is like the same age as me, and following it. And I'm talking about Voyager 1, and something recently happened that's pretty remarkable if you think about it. So after 37 years of coasting through space, which it's about 21 billion kilometers from Earth, that's about 141 times the distance between Earth and the sun. Okay, so that's how far out it's gotten, 37 years to get there. And on Tuesday of last week, they sent some commands that took 19 hours and 35 minutes to reach Voyager. And then they had to wait another 19 hours and 35 minutes to see if the spacecraft responded. And it did. After nearly four decades of dormancy, its rockets turned on and fired perfectly. This is one of those stories where you look at some of the things that were built, in this case before I was born, that are still in use today, technology that is still being used, receiving commands from Earth. That means they must have moved that communication systems to a more modern computer system to some degree. It may still be very old, but it's probably not from 1979. And
mind boggles. Just
it doesn't it?
I have no appreciation for radio engineering, but I can't fathom how that is even possible. And the fact that it is, and the technology has been out there in the extremes of space for that amount of time, and it's still receiving commands and able to function, is nothing short of miraculous. That is quite astonishing.
The sad part of it, though, is that technically they have been sending other commands to it. The commands that they are sending are to the secondary, like, adjustment rockets that haven't been used in, like, 30 years, basically since they launched it.
Yeah, they basically, those attitude control thrusters and stuff, yeah. They're basically falling apart.
Yeah, so they're switching to these secondary rockets, but they're also switching to them because the attitude control are starting to use up an absurd amount of power, and they have very limited power left on there.
I bet.
So they're using the secondary ones to give it another year of life, after which it's basically just going to die.
Oh, well, then I guess it would, but then it has momentum, right? I mean, it won't be sending us any signals.
Nope.
So then it's just a monument of humanity hurling through space.
Yep. Hopefully to reach an alien civilization billions of years from now.
Which does still serve some purpose.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. And it's fun to track it because I feel like I have a connection with it, being that that'd be me. That's where I'd be at right now if I was born on that spacecraft and sent up into space.
Yeah, and it's also the thing we've sent out the furthest into space ever and will continue to be basically forever unless we invent something that goes faster than it. All right, Wimpy, you're kind of an enigma. What did you do in Linux before you got involved with Ubuntu?
Way back when, the first Linux distribution that I used was Idrisil Linux. And that would have been around 1994, 1995, early 1995. And I know this because at work at the time, I was running beta versions of Windows 95.
So
wow.
So the time period would be post Slackware, but pre Red Hat becoming big.
No, actually, this was the, so to explain, the Idrisil Linux floppy disks that I got, I had to drive to a colleague's in a different town and xmodem copy off a PDP mini to my laptop. And then
this is a legit origin story. Yeah. All of a sudden,
you were dedicated even back in the day.
Yeah, and then raw write those to a dozen floppy disks in order to install. And the galling thing is, I did it wrong. I forgot to put the xmodem in binary mode, so I copied all of these floppy images in ASCII mode, and they were all corrupt. So I had to go back 2 weeks later and do it all again.
We all did that. We've all made that mistake. Yep.
So I started with Idrisil Linux, and at that time what I didn't realize is that Idrisil was already defunct. It was finished and abandoned and had petered out in like 1993, and there was me running it like a year later and it was already done. So from there I went to Slackware, and I used Slackware for a long time. And in fact, it was only a couple of days ago I went back to a post I put on Google Plus 2 years ago. I was clearing out the office at home, and I found an old journal, handwritten journal. And the first page of this journal was my notes of what I'd done post-installing Slackware 3.4. And this was in July of 1998. And I'd got all of these detailed notes about, how I'd configured the kernel and additional packages I'd pulled down as tarballs and built from source and what have you. And I used Slackware until around 99. And dabbled with Red Hat for a bit because that was the new hotness, and that made a lot of things easy. And in fact, was running Red Hat on a Spark 20 workstation with a Super Spark processor.
Oh yeah,
on it, so quite kind of an unusual configuration. And the reason that I was using Linux is because my job, right from when I came out of university, pretty much all of the back-end systems were running a Unix of some description or another, or OS 2. So I was either running OS 2 or Unix at work, and Windows just wasn't cutting it for me at home. And I couldn't afford to buy SCO Unix. You know, it was just way too expensive. So when I heard about Linux and it was this Unix operating system that I liked, I decided to give it a go. And so I made the jump from using OS 2 as my home operating system to migrating to Linux.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's where it all came from.
So you were a former OS 2 user as a desktop user. You ran OS 2 on the desktop. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had very little exposure to that. My primary use with OS 2 was much later in life, when it was attached to a mainframe console, and that was how you would start certain processes off on the mainframe. It was an OS 2 workstation, but this was, you know, only 7 or 8 years ago. I had my experience with OS 2 much later in life. And so Linux, how did it do as the replacement on the desktop? Did it manage it okay, or was it lacking?
Well, yes. I mean, back then it was definitely lacking. You had to be a rather dedicated individual. There had to be something about why you were choosing to run Linux, which was why you were running Linux. You know, at that time, the desktop environments like KDE and GNOME were just getting bootstrapped in terms of, you know, projects. You know, they really didn't exist. They were very embryonic. So back then it was all about the window managers. And I can remember one website which was, you know, the index of every window manager that was available. And, you know, you'd got, you know, the various boxes. And my thing that I used at the time was Window Maker, which was a next step like windowing environment. And I can remember having to patch the XOR libraries to make all of the widgets match, so that, and patching TCL and TK so that the widgets match. So when you ran these applications using these different toolkits, they kind of almost sort of looked the same. So I did that for the longest time. Moved from Slackware to Crux, because I found what I was doing with Slackware was installing the thinnest shim of an OS and then building it up from source, because the packages were out of date and I wanted newer stuff. And Crux was still is a from source distribution in the main.
Yeah.
I was a Crux maintainer for several years.
Really? You signed up as a maintainer? I love it. Yeah, what were you maintaining, do you recall?
KDE.
Oh, of course. Sure, of course.
And the only reason was that KDE was easier to build than GNOME back then. I was kind of surprised when I look back, through the mailing list, and I was like, oh my goodness, I was the KDE maintainer. I'd kind of blocked that out from my memory. And then from Crux, I had a Fedora core install for about 5 months. And I can remember writing a blog post saying, this is amazing. I don't have to keep compiling everything from source. This is the future. And then about 3 months later, it was, this is a complete and total mess. It's all fallen apart around me. And that coincided with the first Ubuntu release.
Ah.
So I then switched to Ubuntu and ran Ubuntu for many years until about 2011. And then with the transitions with Unity, which it was very sort of half-baked at that period.
Yeah, early Unity.
As a sort of a final product, but it wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. And I went looking elsewhere, and that's when I switched to Arch and became an Arch TU. And at that point, I was running GNOME 3, so this would have been GNOME, 3.2, 3.4, 3.6, that sort of period.
Yeah, that kind of tracks my progress, at least when it comes to Ubuntu. I was using a lot of different distributions right before Ubuntu came along. So I was sort of primed for a new desktop. I was using a lot of SUSE, a lot of Gentoo, and I was still dabbling. I think it was still called Mandrake back then. And so when Ubuntu came along and it was we're just going to ship one web browser, one email client, one instant messenger. And by the way, it's all of the ones you like. We're going to do Game. We're going to do Thunderbird. We're going to do Firefox. And that was such a departure from, say, Mandrake, which would be installed from like an 8 gigabyte DVD, and because internet connections were so rare and sparse, it would just blast everything down to your hard drive.
You'd have K-Mail, you'd have Thunderbird, you'd have all these other different mail clients, plus all the command line versions. And so that was a real refreshing take with Ubuntu, with a clean desktop,
yeah,
a sync to GNOME releases, with a hand-selected applications. It was really nice. It was attractive. So I moved over myself. But you and I both sort of left when Unity came along. And it's kind of funny to now here we are later on, and both of us are like, you know, Unity's not so bad. But that was just sort of
had 7 years of refinement since you said.
So you spent a long time then on Arch, I take it. You must have spent maybe
3 years, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That is a pretty good. That's about my length too.
Personally, I was quite happy running GNOME 3. Well, not quite happy. I was having to use extensions in order to create a desktop, you know, experience that suited me, but I was able to do that. But because I'd dismissed Ubuntu and therefore Unity, but my family had, you know, I'd moved them over to Ubuntu 6.06, the first LTS, and they'd switched from Windows 2000 to Ubuntu 6.06, and they were very used to that GNOME 2 desktop environment. They're not technical people, didn't particularly want to relearn how to use their computers. So when, after 10.04, reached its end of life, I'd run out of road and I didn't know where to take them. And this is how I got involved in Mate, and I was then installing Arch and Mate on people's laptops, and that was just a horrible, horrible mess.
I tried to do that too. Yeah, I tried to do that too.
Yeah, it didn't go well. And then enter one Alan Pope, who interviewed me on the Ubuntu podcast in, I think, season 7 about Mate. And we had a conversation about, you know, how this project was being continued and what my involvement was and why it still was relevant for many people. And during that interview, I dropped in that, you know, it was a shame that Mate was so horribly broken on Ubuntu, which he was, you know, a little bit irritated by. and then 2 weeks later emailed me with a link to an ISO image, just said, ha, and this ISO image called,
that's so bumpy.
and this ISO image called Matey, and it was essentially Ubuntu 14.10 with the Mate desktop grafted onto it, and that's where Ubuntu Mate really sort of started. And what led to me, obviously, coming back to the Ubuntu community and being quite heavily involved in Ubuntu again.
So, and have you, since you've been back on Ubuntu, did you start right out of the gate running Mate as your desktop of choice, or did you come back, jump on Unity for a while, and more recently move over to Mate?
I bootstrapped, so Popey and I bootstrapped enough of Ubuntu 14.10 with Mate grafted on top,
okay,
and I have run that ever since. Although when I was working on the Ubuntu desktop team, my daily machine was Unity 7.
Oh, sure,
because
yeah.
Obviously,
sure.
If that's what you're working on, you can't be running another desktop environment. That's just stupid. So, yeah, but those 6-7 months when I was running Unity, I really developed an appreciation to where the design and thought that had gone into many of the elements of the Unity desktop and its simplification and user experience that some people find rigid. There's a real elegance there, and that I could see the appeal.
So fast forward some time after that interview on the Ubuntu podcast, and now you find yourself as one of the hosts on the show. And how did that transition come about? And how long ago now was that?
So I think I started with season 8 of the Ubuntu podcast. And like all podcasters know, occasionally things go wrong and you lose an episode.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark and Alan and Laura had recorded the first 2 episodes, I think, or maybe the episodes 3 and 4 of season 8. And there'd been a screw up and one of the presenters' audio was lost.
Oh.
And so they'd lost 2 shows.
Oh.
And I'd obviously got reconnected with Popey through LUP and what have you. Way back we were members of the same LUG locally, but got reconnected through Linux Unplugged. And he pinged me on Telegram and said, we're in a bit of a bind. We've lost these 2 episodes. don't suppose you can come on tonight and help Mark and I, you know, re-record those two episodes? I was like, yep, yeah, okay, I think I can do that. Check with my wife, that was all fine. Mm-hmm. So I recorded those two episodes. And then I think Laura was on holiday, so they invited me back to do another two episodes. And then it was like, oh, well, you know, you're all right at this. Do you want to just join and stick around?
Yeah, and so I really enjoyed you on the show, too. And now it's season 10, episode 39 is the latest episode, so it's been a few seasons. Now you're an old pro at it.
Yeah, I think I'm... I still find it difficult at times.
Mm.
I don't think I'm a natural broadcaster, but I'm very enthusiastic about the topic, and I think that's all that matters, really.
Yeah.
Three seasons, just coming to the end of the third season that I've been involved in. Alan's obviously done all of them, and Mark, I think, has been involved since season two or three. And it's just the three of us now. Sadly, Laura got busy with her studies, so she's no longer a regular host on the show. But we're just closing out season 10. We've got so unlike your podcasts, the Ubuntu podcast runs to a season. So we record from approximately March to December, and then we take a season break where we then go away and reflect on the last season and decide whether we're going to do it again and what we might change.
Mm-hmm, I like that.
So we're just about to enter that. We're going to record the last two episodes of this season, and that will be the Christmas episodes that go out. And then we will take a break for a few months and decide what we're going to do next.
Mm-hmm. I think that's I really like that. And I think if you have a podcast model that isn't advertiser driven, that if say if it was Patreon funded or self-funded in the case of the Ubuntu podcast, I think it's something everybody should consider when they're starting their podcast, is why not take a little reflection time and also take it upon yourself to listen to yourself. Use that time to, you know, listen back to a couple of episodes and listen to yourself. Listen to maybe, is there a noise or is there something I'm doing? Is there some annoying thing I say? That's one of the things that if you keep going and going and going and going, it's hard to have the time to do that kind of reflection.
Yeah.
So I think that's really smart. The advertising model is sort of more based around weekly, and which sort of also matches my sort of rhythm. My schedule sort of orbits around the shows. That sort of sets the pace of my life. So I couldn't do, like, people sometimes come to me and say, Chris, could I do a podcast with you just twice a month? And which is great from a recording standpoint, but it just completely throws off my rhythm, because it means the week that I have that show is just a really busy week. That week's just totally fucked, because it's not like I can just not do things that week. So I still have all my regular things plus the show I record every other week. So I found for me that format just really didn't work. And we tried doing seasons and lasts, and it just didn't really jive with what the audience wanted, any of that. But I think it's a different landscape now. And I think if you were launching a show, or, you know, if you could do it, it's a really smart sort of approach. Plus, it gives you a chance to sort of relieve a little pressure, because that every single week is a real grind for podcasting. It seems like it's, you show up for an hour and you record a show, but of course it's maybe 6 hours of prep work before the show, and you've got to do that every single week. So it's about 8 hours from prep to recording, and then a few more hours for publishing. So just call it 12 hours a week that you have to find time somewhere in your busy schedule to carve out every single show.
Yeah. I mean, for anyone that's recorded podcasts, it's definitely a passion project. You know, I don't want to make it sound like a sob story, like all of the hours that go into the
it's just work.
Show
yeah.
and post show, because the bit where we turn up and you have a chat to your mates for a couple of hours is really why I enjoy doing it. Enjoy that part of it, and it's
that's the best part, isn't it?
Scuba diving, the preparation and cleaning up afterwards is just sort of part of the bit that you enjoy in the middle.
Or any kind of activity like that. I completely agree.
You definitely do need to have some sort of a schedule, though. Like, you can't just say, you know, we're gonna record whenever we feel like it, because then you go like 9 months without doing a show suddenly, and you're wondering what happened.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Well, I really enjoy the show, and I think the last few seasons it's just gotten better and better. And I encourage people to go check it out. We'll have a link in the show notes or go to ubuntupodcast.org. Wimpy, thank you for joining us for this very special edition, this milestone edition of the User Air program. It has been a pleasure, sir.
My pleasure, and thanks for asking me on.